Howdy, folks. It's been a few years, I know. I have been working on the podcast, mainly in outreach. You can read about it on the expanded Whose Voices page on the blog. I've been thinking about the stories I want to put out there, and the stories that I want to hear, need to hear. A couple of weeks ago, I got to hang out and record with my friend Kelly. There was a section of that conversation that was exactly what I want the podcast to be. I'm so excited to play it for you that I put it at the beginning of this episode. On a technical note, there are a couple blips and dips in the volume. That's on my end, not yours. Don't worry, it won't interfere with any of the content at all. Neither will the washing machine or dryer when Kelly's roommate does his laundry. But I apologize nonetheless. I can't wait for you to hear this. I'm going to take you there right now. Enjoy yourselves. Here's my man, Kelly. So let's talk about the title of my podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember, you know, when I first met you and you had mentioning that you had done a podcast and that it was called, you know, Coming Out of the Emerald Closet. My first thought was, oh, interesting, you know, because I've always associated coming out as being a gay thing. You know, I am a gay man, and I always associated coming out as being a gay thing. Like, I never once in a million years thought that coming out could be associated with anything that didn't have to do with your sexuality. And so I was pretty taken aback by your title, and I was taken aback by the cleverness of how you choose to sort of use that play on words of coming out. And it just really made me think of again, coming out in a way that I had never associated it before. Because, yeah.
Do you feel that I have a right to say that?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, because that's the part where I'm feeling like I just need to, like, almost atone to you.
right.
Or at least just thank you. Like, I am clearly appropriating this queer liberatory language.
Right.
Coming out, you know, and here I am just saying, like, oh, as a pot smoker, it's the same. And I don't want to say it's the same. I'm just saying there are parallels.
Oh, absolutely.
It's something you can hide or choose not, you know, some people can hide and choose not to.
Right. Yeah, you know, and I applaud the choice of title. I think it also takes a risk on your part as a heterosexual man, because I think you automatically set yourself up maybe for people to assume you are a homosexual mm-hmm. by the name of your title. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It wasn't necessarily my first thought, but I did think that your podcast had something to do with sexuality when I first heard the title. Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm lying. I didn't necessarily think that, but the thought crossed my mind. I knew what your podcast was about because we had talked about, I think I didn't know the title of your podcast until after I already knew what it was about.
Okay.
And then you were like, yeah, and I call it Coming Out of the Emerald Closet. So I think it's a great title, and again, also a risky one on your part.
Just as being misleading, because I feel like it's, I guess I was thinking of the disrespectful angle, but not the misleading angle, but now I see it's both, so.
No, I don't necessarily, no, I don't mean it in a bad way. You also educated me about, as someone being new to Portland, I didn't understand the emerald part quite as well either.
Okay.
So I guess if you didn't understand the emerald reference and you just heard Coming Out of the Emerald Closet, you might think of it as something as a gay thing. I don't know.
Yeah,
anyway, I think
right.
long story short, I think it's a great title, because here's the point of my story is that it was actually your title that made me start thinking a lot about coming out in different ways, because coming out was a big part of my life as a gay man. Mm-hmm. And I think a gay person certainly has that one huge event where you kind of come out to everyone either all at once or within a very short amount of time, you know, like within a month you come out to everybody you know.
Okay.
But then I also think that as a gay person you come out every day of your life in certain situations.
Just where society like assumes that you're straight,
yeah,
or something?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
And I'm not saying that, well, yeah, I mean, sure, I think a lot of it probably from stereotypes. I think, for example, a lot of people, you know, it's funny because I'm told by a lot of people that I quote unquote pass, you know, which I always find is a very loaded thing. And yeah. I don't know that I want to pass as what, you know, like, I don't know that I want to be on that passing train. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But my point is that I'm told that when you look at me, you assume I'm straight. And then I open my mouth and that whole theory goes down the drain. At least I've been told that many times. So I do think that by the act of opening my mouth and communicating with somebody, I come out of the closet many times a day. At least that's how it feels to me.
Okay,
and sure. I'm not ashamed of that at all.
Okay, yeah.
You know, don't get me wrong. But it made me think that, and I always knew this, I just necessarily didn't have the language around it before, but I used your podcast title as a way to start thinking about how I was so in the closet with my cannabis use. Mm-hmm. And even the fact of, you know, taking a job in the cannabis industry, that was step one in coming out, right? Mm-hmm. Before I even knew it, okay. That was step one. In hindsight, you know, I can firmly say that was step one, but I didn't know it at the time.
I feel like I'm paralleling. That's where I am right now. Like, right. My parents know that this is what my podcast is about, but I haven't fully said.
Right.
I'm getting high with my guests.
Right. I'm getting high while we're doing it. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So good point.
Okay. So
good point.
I'm following in your footsteps. I'm right back at you, man.
And even that, I remember vividly thinking, and this was only a few months ago, you know, that this happened, but I remember thinking about my sisters especially, because I'd never shared with them that I was a cannabis user, much less a daily cannabis user, mm-hmm. right? I was very much in that closet, mm-hmm. that closet that I didn't even realize I was in. And of course, you know, over time, I guess I had thought here and there, sure, life might be easier if everyone just knew, but it was never something nagging enough that I felt like, mm-hmm. you know, it wasn't that sort of thing. It's not like, you know, they lived next door, they were states away. It wasn't like sharing that information was going to be life-changing, nor did it hinder my life in any sort of dramatic way.
Yeah.
But again, it was a part of me that I was keeping hidden, and a very big part of me. Mm. And so, again, I got to thinking about how many people in my life did not know what was a huge part of my life. And it essentially included all of my family except my brother. And a lot of my close friends knew, but like coworkers, for example. Like, I would never in a million years imagine an old boss of mine at Starbucks knowing that I consumed cannabis. Like, that just sounds so foreign to me, right?
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
So long story short, I was one of those gay people that essentially, there is a national coming out day for gay people. It's October 11th.
And which is my birthday.
Which is Chris's birthday, yes.
Yeah,
yes,
right.
Which makes this even, the story even more
I learned that when I turned 19.
Yeah. And it's been a very big thing. And they use it, I remember especially in the beginning, National Coming Out Day was kind of born, in a sense, to help give people the courage and a platform to come out. And I was one of those people who drank the Kool-Aid, and I used it as the day to come out. So I came out on 10/11/90. I will always remember that date till the day I die. And I think that, again, that was
our junior year.
Yeah, exactly. Yep, and that was the big coming out. Again, that was when I told my mom, mm-hmm. And my stepfather and my grandmother. There was a couple, I'm going to say maybe two people in my life that knew, but it was very quiet and not even confirmed. It was more like a, I think I might be gay sort of thing, you know. Mm-hmm. But 10/11/90 was definitely the big day that I came out. And so every year on National Coming Out Day, I tend to not only remember my own coming out story as a gay man, but I also remember, it just kind of makes me think about other people's stories and how over time, especially, I think, in the last probably 5 years, or no, I'm going to say maybe 10 years, I think Trump's presidency has set us back a little bit. But no, it really hasn't. It really hasn't, because the thought values haven't changed. Mm-hmm. But I don't think kids today look at gayness as quite a thing that even needs to be come out. It just seems so much more natural to have or to know gay people or trans people even. Like, God, at 13, sure, there were trans people. I know there were. But no one was talking about them or like, no one was coming out as trans when I was, you know, 13 years old. And I think about your son, who you were sharing, you know, has a friend with two moms or whatever you were telling me. Yeah. You know, and it's so, it's not something that he thinks about as weird. And I think even you made a comment that was more weird, that he was like, what are you talking about? Do you remember what I'm talking about?
It might have been the time where he... We were watching a sitcom, and there was a lesbian couple.
Yes, yes.
And he said, I guess it came out that they were married. They said married.
Right.
You know, and it was like, I'm married, and this is my wife.
Right,
and
right,
for
right.
him to hear a woman say, this is my wife.
Right.
You know, it was kind of like a thing. And so he was like, are they, you know... So, I don't know. See, he had some kind of question, like, are they married together or to each other or something like that. We're like, yeah, and he made this, like, thinking face.
Right, 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 that's what it was.
My wife and I kind of looked at him, and we're like, let's not jump on him, let's let it, you know, see how this goes.
Right.
And, I don't remember exactly what his next thing was, but it kind of came out that we were just like, yeah, you know, sometimes men fall in love with men, or women fall in love with women.
Right.
And, you know, if they want to get married and do the family thing, that's their deal. And he says, and he was still kind of sitting with this, like, huh, kind right. of look on his face. And so I reminded him of his best friend.
Yeah.
Like, you know, your homie.
Right, right.
And I just, that was when I saw the wheels turn, because
right,
his friend has two moms.
Right.
And my son has gone over there to play, like, tons of times. They trick-or-treat together every
right,
year.
Right.
And he had just never pieced together that they were a couple.
Right.
He probably never thought about what they, quote-unquote, were.
Right.
They were just the two parents in the household.
Right, exactly.
But this was where he finally put together, like, oh, and they love each other. Okay.
Right, right, right. Yeah. And see, that's such a cool thing for him to be able to put together, because I didn't even, at his age, when, you know, and probably you're the same, there was nobody of the same sex living together that I knew of.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
that I was playing with, you know, their children. So, yeah, it's just kind of a different thing now in the whole concept of what it means to come out. And I just don't think that I kind of, like, again, it goes back to you just being so clever with your name, and it just made me really realize that you don't have to necessarily equate it with just a gay thing anymore, and you can use it in so many different areas of your life. And so that's what I did. It was coming out day, and I didn't have it planned, honestly. Even though you'd given me a lot of thoughts around it, and I kept thinking to myself that I wanted to use the conversations that you and I had and essentially come out as a cannabis user. But I didn't know that I was going to do it on National Coming Out Day until I logged into Facebook that morning and I was reminded that it was Coming Out Day. Because I hadn't, it was still early in the morning, so I really hadn't thought about what day it was yet, you know. So I was like, oh yeah, it's Coming Out Day. And then it was early in the morning and I had just, I remember I just smoked some sort of, it was sativa of some sort, and I was, you know, feeling focused and good. And next thing I know, I had written out this whole post on Facebook, essentially telling everybody that knows me, because I'm Facebook friends with literally everybody that I know in my life. And there's not one person that I can think of in my life that isn't on Facebook, honestly. And so it was me coming out as a cannabis user, and it was so... It was almost just the same as coming out as gay, in a weird way, in the sort of sense of fear that I felt going into it, because the fear that I felt was mostly, honestly, Chris, I didn't give a fuck what anyone felt, but it still felt. I think my fear came more from the negative connotations that go around cannabis use. That still exist. And I didn't want anybody... I guess I feared people looking at me as that stoner stereotype that we just talked about, I guess. You know what I mean? Because, again, people that I'm Facebook friends with are old bosses from Starbucks, old peers from Starbucks,
wow.
like my entire family. Anybody that's close to me that did not know found out on October 11th, 2018, that I was a cannabis user. And I had kind of come out, to backtrack just a little bit, I had kind of come out a little bit, like you were, you know, alluding to earlier, with like that soft sort of intro with like, hey guys, I'm suddenly dropping, I'm quitting my job at Starbucks after 18 years, and I'm moving across country to be general manager of a cannabis shop. You know, that was the first step. And again, it goes back to my sister, my oldest sister specifically. And I think I worry, even though, you know, it's funny, she's a very cool person and we love each other dearly, but I don't know why I should have given her more credit in hindsight, because I was worried about disappointing her more than anybody. Like when all of my cannabis thoughts came out, when I was, you know, preparing my coming out story, if you will, it was all about not wanting to disappoint her.
Mm.
And maybe that's because she's my oldest sibling. She's in her 60s. I guess I don't have to tell everyone her real age, but she's in her 60s. She's a little bit older than me. She's the oldest of all of us, and I no longer have my parents. So I guess she's kind of like the maternal figure, if you will, of the family.
Yeah, again, I guess as you age,
So, and she's... I guess is the oldest, you know, you kind of like, even though I have a ton of feelings of like that for my brother, who's also older than me, I feel it kind of in a different way for my sister. Cause my brother always knew about my cannabis use, right? But my sister did not. So I guess it just kind of made the dynamic a little bit different, but I was so scared that she was going to think I was weird or crazy, or I didn't want her to worry about me. You know, we're very much alike, and you know, it's very funny, we're both Pisces, you know, and we both worry a lot, and hence my medicinal use for anxiety. and so I just I guess I didn't want to burden her with my cannabis use. And in hindsight, that was a heavy burden for me to carry as well. And I didn't quite realize that at the time, because even though I was just speaking to that fear prior, as I was writing out my post, and, you know, I don't know if you've ever done this before. I'm sure everybody has on social media, where you're about to announce something big or make big news or something, and you read that post like probably 100 times before you post it, just making sure it's perfect and that it's exactly how you want it to sound.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I was doing. You know, I was stressing over that post, and then I hit send, and that's when I guess that burden lifted, if you will. That metaphorical burden, I guess, if you will, you know, but I felt it at the same time, and I knew that there was no turning back at that time, and I didn't care. Again, after it was posted, I think I'd said this already, I didn't care. It wasn't that I cared what anyone really felt, other than I just didn't want them to think that I was, again, that stereotypical stoner.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've learned in all of this is that, it's a lesson I've already learned, but I guess I didn't learn it well enough, because I've learned it several times in my life, is that sometimes I just don't give people enough credit for what they're willing to accept, or what you think they might not understand. And in fact, it's been exactly the opposite, where I think I probably have strengthened my relationship, definitely with my sister, just by sharing with her a big part of my life. Even though it's, you know, she's not a user herself, so she really doesn't understand, I guess, what it's all about. But she doesn't use her lack of understanding as any way of judgment either. And
okay.
I guess I guess it's always easier to think that, you know, somebody who doesn't smoke is not going to have a positive, you know, light on it. But sometimes people will prove you wrong, and I guess that's my point in all of this, is that it's strengthened my relationships with most people I know. And in fact, I'm learning through some of my Facebook interactions that people from my past that I never knew, or that never knew that I consumed, I'm learning that I think they're consumers too. And we just didn't know each other.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about old bosses and old coworkers and just the comments that I'm getting on Facebook, because now that you've inspired me, and again, I don't want to sound cheesy, Chris, but you did a huge thing, and I know, trust me, I know it sounds cheesy, but it was really you who inspired all of this to happen, and I'm a firm believer that everything happens as it's supposed to, and I've told you that before, but I do think that part of your reasoning of coming into my life was to help me tell my story, you know, and I think that everybody that's in your life is there for some reason. And sometimes it's very obvious. And sometimes those reasons, there's multiple reasons, and they just keep happening over and over. Like, you know, just the other day when, like, it blew me away, that, no joke, that
you... Yeah, that was wild.
So you texted me I thought I had sent you an email.
I was like, dude, we got to get this interview.
Like, no joke, I got to work and I started typing you an email. And the email literally said, can we please hang out before Thanksgiving? Sorry I haven't been able to get together. My schedule's been crazy. And I swear, I thought it was sent. And then I get your message. And then I'm like, oh, he's just responding by text because he saw my email, right? And then I open my laptop and it's sitting there in the fucking draft folder. Never sent. And it was essentially you asked me exactly what I was asking you, but you didn't know that I was asking you. So it was just very funny that again, it's just further proof that energy exists, and I do believe that you can send thoughts to people, and I've seen it happen more than once, and this is just proof to me that I'm not saying that I don't get me wrong, I didn't consciously sit down and send you, like, let me telepathically send thoughts to Chris.
Mark calling Austin.
But somehow you got the energy that I put out there because you were thinking about the same thing at the same time, where I thought nothing of getting your text. You know? It was not out of the blue. So I was just like, oh, cool, he's responding, you know? You know, so that was that. But yeah, I think that when I look back again, going back to my Facebook interactions, it's just really strengthened. It's strengthened my community, and I think that I've also been able to educate a lot of people on cannabis use, both medicinally and recreationally. And you know, I have different people reaching out to me with questions about you know, how they can bring cannabis into their lives medicinally for different reasons. So I know that I'm out there making a difference. I just never, you know, it's just, it's almost overwhelming to me when I truly sit back and think that, just how crazy life works and how just kind of like, just how right on the universe is. And that, I think I shared with you before, like, before I had moved here, even like, you know, the day before I got offered the job out here, if you had told me that I was going to be living in Oregon, I would have told you you were crazy. You know what I mean? I had no intention of leaving Starbucks or leaving Massachusetts. I had no intention of getting this job offer out of the blue. So again, it's like my life completely changed, and I got offered a job and literally, I mean, I don't think anyone can deny that this is really a dream industry to work in. I mean, yeah, it's still a business and it's hard and it's work, but at the end of the day, I mean, you're dealing with cannabis. I mean, let's be honest, like, how hard can it be?
Well, you're dealing with people who are interested in, you know, like, right. Everyone wants to be there.
Right,
that's
exactly.
Enough for me.
Exactly, and so I think about that my life, you know, you know, 4 months ago, I never in a million years would have thought that I'd be sitting here with you in Portland, working in the cannabis industry, talking about cannabis on this podcast, coming out as a cannabis user. Again, it's just so funny how quickly life can change, and goes back to how I believe that everything happens. I don't know that it's all planned, but it's I don't know.
I've heard the adjective lawful.
Yeah.
It's not that, you know, it's all lawful. It's all unfolding according to laws.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, exactly. And I just think that you and I are certainly, or this conversation, rather, is 100% proof to that. Because had I not been offered the job, I would guarantee you still be in Massachusetts working for Starbucks in the cannabis closet, unhappy with my life. And now it's been completely, you know, turned upside down in a good way. And again, it just, I don't know. It's lawful. Yeah. It's just lawful. Yeah. I just hope that, you know, with your podcast, again, I know it sounds cheesy, but I love how you've inspired me, and I hope that you can do that for somebody else, because it is so empowering. And I hope that over time, you know, you find the space to fully tell your story, and that I can, you know, just hear about what that's like for you, because I think that again, once you think about how empowering it is to come out as anything that you want to come out as, that's scary. You know, working through that fear and coming out the other side successful, I think is really what it's all about, you know? So, yeah.
Wow, man. I'm honored to be a part of your coming out process.
Yeah, yeah. That's definitely.
I can't imagine myself saying those words, you know, if you told me, you know, X days ago.
Right. You know. And, you know, like I said, I didn't know I needed to tell my story. You know, kind of a little bit, but again, it wasn't until it was actually happening and that I had met you that I realized how harmful it was to hide from everybody I know something that was such a huge part of my existence. And just like, you know, Chris, you might experience this sometimes in your interactions, you know, where you're in situations where you have to appear, you know, normal, or you have to appear not fucked up or stoned or whatever words mm-hmm. you want to use. Mm-hmm. And don't get me wrong, I'm not stoned 24/7 all the time. It's not like that. You know, there are parts of my day where I'm not consuming. But my point is that when you're in that closet, there's so much hiding where it's like you may have consumed, yet your mom calls and you're like, fuck, I can't talk to my mother right now. She's going to know I'm stoned. Or you just consumed and, you know, your best friend is like, hey, dude, can you just come pick me up and take me to blah, blah, blah? And you're like, no, I can't drive right now, you know, because I've consumed that much where, no, I'm not comfortable driving a car right now,
smart,
you know?
So,
yeah, it's just living your life in a different way, whereas now it's like, here's a perfect example. This will completely hit it home for you. Manager at Starbucks, an employee calls in sick, I have to go in and cover, yet I just consumed.
Mm.
Fuck. That's like the worst feeling in the world. You're going to work stoned because you have to, right? Here. No, it's again because you can't appear stoned.
I'm just laughing because you hit the nail on the head,
you
know, so squarely.
You got to show up looking like you got your shit together. You know, you're the manager.
The whole idea of like getting stoned and then trying to pass off as putting energy into appearing not stoned
right.
is just the most counterproductive
right.
shit.
Whereas here, you know, I'm chilling out, an employee calls in sick. I'm like, okay, sure, let me finish my joint. I'll be right in. You know, it's no big deal. There's a lot less hiding once you come out of the closet. Mm. And if someone happens to see you when you're stoned, so the fuck what? You know, you've told your story. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's no longer, it's almost like it's no longer my burden. I don't care what you do with the information. That's not my problem.
Mm.
You know, I've made my peace with it.
Yeah.
You know, you can do whatever you want with it. You know, you can do nothing with it. You know, whatever you decide is appropriate for you, but it's no longer my issue. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So again, just knowing that I don't have to hide if I may have, you know, consumed to a point where it's noticeable. Sure, who cares? You know, it's no longer my problem.
Yeah. I'm really not into keeping secrets. Secrets are. Maintaining secrets is the worst.
Yeah, it is. It is, and it definitely eats at you. So, yeah, I definitely feel liberated telling that secret. And again, I came out on the other side feeling even more empowered because now people who I, never would have thought of or asking me for advice, you know? And so it's almost like, in a way, you empowering me has empowered others. You know what I mean? Through the, because I've now presented myself as a resource to people because of you. So you've actually affected more people than just me.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's a pretty cool thing. Yeah. Wow. And I have a stronger relationship with my sister, which is very important to me. So,
there you go. See, you and family.
So, yeah, there you go. Exactly. And she might even end up consuming.
Wow. Yeah, maybe. Yeah. And she has the perfect resource to come to.
I know.
Yeah.
It is interesting how suddenly it's like everyone has questions. And plus, everybody I know is in states where it is legal, at least medicinally. So I'm always like, just get your medical card if you do have that option. So no one that I'm talking to is in states where they have absolutely no access to it, which is still very real in some places, you know. Mm-hmm. So at the very least, they do have access to it. But yeah, it is very empowering to know that you can change somebody's life. And, you know, in a way, you know, Chris, I don't want to say that we're like the front runners or whatever, because I know that there's been people doing a lot more important work for a lot longer in the cannabis industry. But I would like to say that in a small way, people like you are helping to change the minds of the mass thought form around cannabis. And I think that's just important as changing the laws, is changing the thought forms. And it really just in my opinion, it starts with realizing that, you know, I always hate to use the word normal, but normal people are smoking cannabis, you know, and eating edibles and doing all this shit. So I think once more and more people realize that it's not something to be ashamed of, that's when we're really going to see real change. And not until then. That's just my opinion. Because Massachusetts is proof. It's been voted into law, yet it's having a very hard time getting off the ground. Right? And again, I think it goes back to that.
I think when you see more people that you know use cannabis.
Right,
different kinds of people using it in different ways.
Right. And so again, it starts with people like you who are willing to get that conversation started, because I don't think there's a lot of people right now that are necessarily doing that at the grassroots level, you know.
Yeah, it's important.
It is important. So yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Wow, thank you. That was wonderful to hear.
A very special episode.
I know. I'm left untouched, like at the end. Now, I can't figure out how to wrap it up. I'm just like, oh man, I'm just feeling all my good feelings.
Yeah. Hey, well then, hey, you know, wrap it up with that then. All the good feels.
All right. Let's take a couple bong hits and some photographs. So, howdy folks, it is the 17th of November, 2018, and I'm sitting in the cozy, comfy basement of my new friend Kelly Shepherd, who I met a couple weeks ago. I'll give a quick little intro story about how we met. We were at the opening of a local dispensary, and it was a really nice spread too. There was like lox and all kinds of good food there.
Eggs, yes. It was very nice.
And, you were on one of the couches, and I think I just started talking to you about... I don't even remember how it started, but
Someone introduced us, but I don't remember who. And then I had come over, and we, literally talked for probably an hour. a while, yeah.
Yeah, and I told you about, the podcast project I was working on. And, you seemed into the idea of cross-cultural conversations, from there we just kind of started sharing our stories about how we got to where we are. So can you start us off with telling me and our listeners where you come from and what brought you out here?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm an East Coaster originally. I was born in Maryland, and I was actually living in Massachusetts right before I moved to Portland, and I was working for Starbucks. I had been with them for a little over 18 years, and I was managing retail locations, doing single unit and multi-unit management, and I got a call to see if I could move out to Portland to manage a dispensary. And I decided that I was going to give up everything and take a chance and move out. And wow. That's ultimately what brought me to Portland. I had never lived on the West Coast before, and I didn't know much about West Coast living. And I knew that cannabis was legal, which was a huge deciding factor.
Was cannabis much a part of your life in Massachusetts?
It was. However, it wasn't. Right as I was leaving, it just became legal recreationally. Okay. The medical market was already established, but I did not have my medical card in Massachusetts. I didn't even actually bother trying to get a medical card because I liked my dealer so much. And mm-hmm. while it would have been, I think, nice to be able to go and experience a dispensary, I just never felt like it was something that I made time to do because I had such a long-standing relationship with my dealer, you know, so mm-hmm. it's just something mm-hmm. that I kind of stuck with. However, when right as I was leaving Massachusetts, like I was saying, the recreational market was becoming legal and the towns were fighting it really hardcore. And most towns were really vehemently, even though the voters had brought it to a yes vote, mm-hmm. so many people were still challenging letting the dispensaries actually open. And it became, the landscape was actually really interesting for a while, and it still looked this way when I left, and in that everybody had, like, on their lawn or something, you know, one of those signs or a sticker or something that said, yeah. "Think of our kids," you know, "No pot shop on Elliott Street," or you know, "What will it do to our future?" You know, just all the negative.
It seems to be the first couple, you know, the first wave of resistance is, "What about the kids?" And
right, yeah. exactly, and you know, I mean. What I find interesting is that, you know, Massachusetts, I've done a lot of thought around this, is it's a very highly educated state. You know, we have a lot of colleges and institutions there. Yet there's a lot of mm-hmm. negativity and ignorance around cannabis. Yet study after study proves that, you know, opening that pot shop on Elliott Street isn't going to harm your children in mm-hmm. any way whatsoever, you know?
So was cannabis not really socially... except, I mean, I'm assuming there are pockets where it's more and less acceptable, but I'm just thinking, like, the general culture of it, was it something that was people tolerated as long as you kept it, as long as they didn't see it or hear it?
Yeah, it was like, I tolerate it as long as it's not in my backyard, you know, but it's got to be in somebody's backyard, you know, at the end of the day. And I think that even though I wish I could remember the statistic or the actual voter percentage of people that approved the bill of legalizing cannabis, I mean, it was astronomically high, right?
Okay.
Yet, again, there was so much opposition to not letting it happen in specific towns. And I know that there's, you know, I did some research when I got to Portland, and I know that there's a lot of towns in Oregon where it's illegal to open a cannabis shop because the voters, you know, have outvoted it at the local level. So I think, you know, again, it's a combination of wanting it to be legal but not wanting it in your backyard. But then I also questioned a lot about, is it just wanting to appear hip? You know, I think Massachusetts, I think a lot of the people that live there, you know, you talk a lot about old money when it comes to Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a lot of people there that want to appear that they're hip and that they're on the forefront of quote unquote doing the right thing, you know.
Okay. The right
in so many ways. I'm talking about, you know, it could flow over into so many different issues. From, you know, one of the big issues that was just on the ballot in Massachusetts for this last election was, and it was very surprising to me, was upholding transgender rights. And, mm-hmm. you know, when, like, a long time ago, we had almost unanimously voted that transgender people would have all those protections in the workplace and all of that in Massachusetts. And yet, somehow, this last election, and it ended up back on the ballot as a possibility of not being a protection for transgender people. Mm.
Oregon had a couple similar measures that were just steps backwards.
Just step backwards, you know, and I think that we can all kind of, you know, speculate and can, you know, where that is coming from with our current state of politics, but it just kind of surprised me, and that it just kind of speaks to, you know, people in Massachusetts want to appear very hip, but then sometimes things like this appear back on the ballot. And luckily, it overwhelmingly passed again, where transgender people do have their protections, But again, it's just like that's an example of how it's crossed different areas of voting in Massachusetts. So when I left Massachusetts, there still was not a recreational shop opened. Mm-hmm. And I just found out, I want to say a week ago, the first one finally opened. And it wasn't even in Boston, oddly enough. It's way out in western Massachusetts, which it actually doesn't really surprise me because there's a lot of, like UMass Amherst is out there, a lot of schools, you know what I mean? So a lot of college towns are out there. So it does kind of make sense. However, they're already talking about there's this huge shortage of cannabis. And it's just...
Well, that happened in Colorado, I think.
And I don't know, you know, I think we could probably sit here and come up with ways to say negative things about every state and how they've rolled out their programs, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's certainly, Oregon has its tons of issues as well.
Sure.
But when I hear that states are having issues with not having enough cannabis when 70% of our cannabis goes unsold here in Oregon because there's just so damn much of it, mm-hmm. you know, because they let too many licenses get started. That just baffles me.
You know, when they decided that there would be unlimited licenses to be awarded for producers, that struck me as a cash grab from outside of the cannabis community. Like, you don't realize there's a lot of cannabis growers in Oregon mm-hmm. already, and a lot of them would love the protection of going into either a medical or a recreational licensed growing sort of relationship with the state. That's what happens. You give unlimited number of licenses, and then you have three times as much pot as the state can smoke, and it's already a pretty hard-smoking state.
I know. But, you know, like I've said to you before, I don't know how we make any money in cannabis at all in this state, because, I mean, we're just tripping over it. So I don't know how it's just not, like, sitting in bunches on street corners for anyone to grab. You know what I mean? Like, where does all this cannabis go that's unsold? Again, it just baffles me that anybody has to pay for it here. Mm-hmm. You know? So, yeah.
But, so you were talking how in Massachusetts they have a shortage.
Yes.
I guess.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, I guess I don't know the cannabis culture of Mass. I mean, I'm sure it's different all over the state. I visited, when I lived in Virginia, I visited a friend at UMass Amherst, and it seemed like a very pot-friendly town.
Oh, absolutely.
It's a college town, that's fine. You know, it's not too big of a stretch of the imagination. But I didn't know if they had, like, the sort of urban-rural divide that Oregon has, where Eugene and Portland, you know, all seem to vote in one, you know, one respect, and because we have the population, we kind of sway the state's votes in a lot of ways. Even though you have much larger swaths of the state, they're just less populated. And those, you know, a lot of the folks in those rural parts of Oregon aren't interested in cannabis legalization or trans rights or, you know, any of the sort of, like, what might be categorized as social justice issues or equality issues.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm wondering what Massachusetts' cannabis culture was like.
Right, yeah, you know, it's interesting because it's not quite the way, like you mentioned, in Oregon, where we pretty much stay a blue state by Portland and Eugene, right? But the rest of the state is very much red. However, in Massachusetts, it's not that way. It is mostly a blue state. And most of the towns, with the exception of some, I wish I had come prepared with some statistics, but I didn't actually know we would be talking about Massachusetts today. But again, most towns approved it. So when you, because I remember vividly looking at a map of Massachusetts that was a town map, you know, so all the little towns were broken down and it was either blue or red based on how you voted on the topic. And it was mostly blue with just a tiny bit of speckled red. Mm-hmm. And none of those towns were even close to the populous parts of Massachusetts, Boston obviously being the most, followed by Springfield and Worcester as the other two larger cities in Massachusetts. So those urban areas most definitely voted for all the legalization of cannabis, both medically and recreational. You know, I was in Massachusetts for both votes, and it was just interesting how medical seemed to roll. And again, I'm not a medical patient in Massachusetts, so I can't speak to it. But it just seemed, in my mind, it just seemed like it was working so much better than how Massachusetts is handling the recreational market. And, you know, I still wanted to go back to something that we had said about saying that there's a shortage in weed. I want to clarify. I don't think that there's a shortage in weed in Massachusetts. I think there's a shortage of certified and licensed weed in Massachusetts.
Okay.
Because I don't think the state has done a good job getting together the different processes that they're going to use to regulate, you know, the cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
I think the vote passed and then suddenly all this scrambling started happening as to how we're going to do this. Oregon and all the unsold, like even though a lot of it goes to the black market, a lot of it still goes completely unconsumed.
Yeah.
And that just hurts my heart. I used to have this thing at Starbucks where every coffee bean counts, right? And you might not think about it when you look at how small a coffee bean is. But a lot of love went into that coffee bean so that it could do what it's supposed to do, right? And one farmer or a family of farmers put a lot of work into making sure that that bean was perfect for Starbucks, right? And so when a barista or somebody would drop, when I would accidentally drop some beans on the floor, it would just hurt my heart because I would think that bean is never going to get to fulfill its destiny,
mm-hmm.
which is to mm-hmm. be coffee and give me that, you know, that feeling that I want to feel in the morning, you know, that you know what coffee does, obviously. But,
sure.
You know, I feel the same way about cannabis. There's cannabis that never fulfills its destiny,
mm.
and it ends up destroyed
mm-hmm.
because of our own legal bullshit.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my rant on that.
Let's talk about some coming out stories. Do you mind if I ask your age?
Yeah, I'm 44.
Wow, I'm 44. Did you graduate in 92?
I did.
Oh, wow, we're the exact same.
I know, yeah, it's pretty cool. And, you know, it's funny because now, you know, checking IDs is a huge part of my life, and it just makes me feel even older when I'm checking people's IDs that they were, you know, when I worked at Starbucks, I was no joke hiring people that were born in 1992, which just made me
wow.
feel really old. But then, now in the cannabis world, I'm seeing a lot of the 92s as well, because, you know, they're old enough to buy cannabis. So it just makes me feel old. But anyway.
All right, well, I see you're packing up the bong here.
Yes, I'm actually packing up a strain called La Sage. And this, it's a hybrid, but it's more of a sativa-leaning hybrid. And I'm very proud. I don't want to say I'm very proud of this strain, but I'm kind of proud of this strain because one of my job, well, as a general manager, my main job is not procurement. I focus on many things, the overall operation of the store. So I actually have somebody who does procurement for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I rely on him to really decide what's good, what's not good. And I rely on his expertise to really know that we are working with the best farms out there, because one of our missions is that we are having the best quality cannabis out there, and that we're not using any artificial fertilizers or anything like that. The reason I was saying that I was proud is because I actually found this farm on my own, and I don't know if I'm going to share the name of the farm. Or maybe I should. I don't know. I don't know if it matters.
Why not?
So this is from Potent Farms.
Okay.
It's actually the largest indoor grow in Oregon. But the reason that I'm proud of this is because my CEO really wanted us to work with this farm for a lot of reasons. One that is that they have a good product, and so I created the relationship and chose the strains that we were going to carry. And long story short, I'm just pretty happy with what I chose. yeah. Again, I don't do a lot of the purchasing because I'm just, you know, pulled in so many different directions. And we have somebody that really knows what they're doing that focuses on that for us.
Mm-hmm.
So just the fact that I as a kind of like a side project in my spare time, I was like, well, I'm going to find a farm on my own and I'm going to pick the strains, and you know, everyone's happy. So, and it's selling well. So this is La Sage.
Cool.
Yeah. And then we also got their Tangy and their Bubble Bomb right now, which is amazing also.
Okay. Yeah. I've been seeing Tangy a lot lately.
Tangy is what it's all about, actually. Okay. I will go on record. I actually said this yesterday, is that the Tangy by Potent Farms might be one of my all-time favorite sativa strains.
Oh.
I'm literally going to say that. Yeah.
All right.
And I do have some over there that we could have packed up, but we didn't. I don't know what it is about the Tangy, but there's just something about it that it's a true sativa. It makes me want to get shit done,
okay.
You know,
right.
And it just has a fantastic taste and a fantastic smell. I think the Potent Farms I think it's Skunk and Cali Orange were the two parent plants that they used to create this strain.
Okay.
And when you look at it under the microscope, it's like, whoa. It's like 3D, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Pretty cool. So, yeah. So that's what we're going to be smoking today. So I'm going to go ahead and rip this up, if you don't mind.
No, not at all. Go for it. Yeah, I was curious to start. I was thinking about talking about, some coming out stories, now that we've had a bit of an introduction as to who you are and, you know, everyone kind of knows me already. Yeah, hearing some of your, I guess it starts off with, were you ever, you know, in any kind of cannabis closet? Did you ever have to keep it from anyone?
Well, yeah.
You know, so let's, I guess we can get into personal history. Like, so, like, how old are you when you take an interest, and what goes from taking an interest to actually partaking, and how do you procure?
Yeah, so actually, I might be, you know, I know everyone has a different story. I grew up in rural southern Maryland, land of alcoholics, land of drive-in liquor stores, land of bars, you know, pretty much either if you were of age, or you had a DUI or an OUI, wherever you, whatever you call it, depending on where you're from, or you knew somebody who had a, an OUI. So again, most of the culture around where I grew up was around alcohol. I didn't even know what cannabis was until I was 18 and had already graduated from high school. And I don't know how I managed to fly under the radar the way that I did. Because, you know, you hear so many stories about, oh, yeah, I started smoking when I was in, like, eighth grade, or, you know, I had my first joint when I was 12, or, you know, I've heard a lot of those stories. But for whatever reason, it never crossed my path at all. And then I remember I was working at a restaurant called Perkins. I don't know if you know it. Do you know Perkins?
No.
So it's one of those, like, family restaurants. It's a chain. It's one of those restaurant chains that people franchise. So, you know, you buy your own Perkins. Anyway, it was a great job at the time. I was waiting tables. Think of a diner, but a little bit more fancy. Kind of like a Denny's, I guess.
Okay.
Right? Okay. So I was waiting tables, and I was working with this girl named Leanne. I remember her vividly, and I don't know whatever happened to her. Now that I think about it, and I haven't really thought about her in a long time, but I do think about her occasionally when I do think about my cannabis story, because her boyfriend was a dealer, if you will. You know, I think he might have actually been the type of dealer that literally sold on the street corner. You know, was just like, you know, there hanging out, and everyone knew where to find them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know for sure, but that's how I remember it in my head. Okay.
Okay.
And so I remember it being available. It's funny that I even use this term, because I haven't thought about it in so long, but he had a dime bag. You know, do you remember those? Right? Did they even
sell? I never bought one, but
okay.
I just went for eights.
I bought many a dime bag in my time. In fact, you know, when we talk about, like, most of my good stories come out of Baltimore, don't even come out of southern Maryland where I grew up. But anyway, so he had it, and I remember smoking it, but I don't remember exactly why I smoked it. I don't remember feeling peer pressure, like, you know, you got to smoke this to feel like you fit in. I don't know if I bought it.
Was it with your friend?
It was with my friend in her apartment. She was older than I was. She was a few years older than I was, and yeah, she had her own apartment. I was still living at home with my mother and my stepfather at the time, and my little sister was still living at home with us as well. And so this was literally the first summer after I'd graduated from high school. No, okay, let me back up.
Okay,
let me back up. This was the summer before my senior year in high school. I totally just lied to you. It was the summer before my senior year. So I did smoke in high school, but it wasn't a lot. But I do remember this one moment. Again, it was with my friend. And
yeah, let's hear that first classic moment.
But again, I don't know if there was peer pressure, but I remember I...
Was it just the two of you?
No, it was her and her boyfriend.
Okay.
The guy that had the dime bag.
Oh, okay. Right.
The dealer guy. Sure. You know?
Were you watching a movie or listening to music or just laying out on the back?
It was very. It was a very weird situation because she really didn't have any furniture, and I don't think she had a TV now that I remember correctly. So I don't think we were listening to anything because I always remember that when I was at her apartment, I was on the floor. So I don't. Yeah, I don't think she had any furniture, but she had the apartment. And I don't think it's because my memory is fuzzy. I think it's just because I don't think we really smoked. I think it was just like it just happened all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might have been, now that I'm talking through it, I think it might have been that she wasn't dating this guy when I first met her. Okay. And then she met this guy who was the dealer, so suddenly there was a dime bag in my lap.
Okay.
I think that's how it worked.
That makes sense.
So I remember that we hit this joint, and I only had a couple puffs. And I can still remember to this day, and this is what I like about the story, is that I can still remember to this day how it made me feel to me at the time as somebody who had never smoked before. Okay. It felt like this was like the best high that I could ever possibly feel.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Positive.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
But I didn't do anything. I sat on the floor in a little ball and just kind of zoned out.
Yeah.
And didn't talk to anybody and didn't really move.
Those first few experiences can be overwhelming.
Yeah. Fast forward to me moving to Baltimore after I graduated from high school, and then I met my
friends. And that's when you were like...
And that's when I was like, oh, you know, every day, immediately. Yeah.
So you met a group of folks that were into it?
I did. I met four people. Well, actually, I met more. Yeah, I only met four people in my life. Yeah, I met four people that.
But like the crew that you kind of latched into.
To this day, four people from that time are still four of my best friends.
Cool.
And we still keep in touch.
Cool.
Yeah. And through that time, that's when weed became fun for me. You know, and that's when it was really.
When you were like, just.
Curled up into a ball, right? That's when it was more about...
But that was pleasant. You were feeling good.
I was, but it wasn't a social experience.
Okay.
But now I'm in Baltimore with my friends, okay. And suddenly it's about, you know, passing the bong around in the circle, and it's about, you know, having fun times, and, you know... And
circle culture, very cool.
Yeah, and a huge part of what we did, I don't know if you're going to be familiar, but you might, I think you probably will be, but we spent a lot of time watching Absolutely Fabulous, the British TV show.
Oh, yeah, that's a great show.
Yes, and it was new at the time. So,
oh, yeah.
So we were lucky enough to be
experiencing it. I was sure to get excited about watching
it. Yeah, so we would literally get so fucking stoned watching AbFab, like to some points where I would literally vividly remember like waking up to the theme song because we would be in the VCR at the time, and for some reason I think it would like keep playing the theme, or like the, you know what I'm talking about, like the beginning credits, it would keep looping.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So the music kept playing.
That Wheels of Fire
yeah, song, right. And I can remember like waking up at like 4 in the morning to that Wheels on Fire song. But yeah, that's when it was really fun.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, it was still, you know, to go back to what I was saying earlier, when I look back on my life in Baltimore, it's really surprising that I didn't end up in jail. Because we used to buy our weed in an alley, literally an alley, in one of the worst neighborhoods in Baltimore.
So you were really familiar with what I would call them open air drug deals.
Yes.
Because what with me it was always, even like in high school, like either someone comes to your house or you go to someone's house.
No, I didn't experience that until I moved to New York. looking back at it, it seems so weird to me, but at the time it felt fine. But yeah, we would literally, and I'm not even joking, drive into what you would consider an alley. And once your car was in the alley, it's like you had no choice, but you were in. You know, like there was no backing out once you made that turn into the alley in your car. Because the drug dealers were going to approach you once you got in that alley. And technically, when I'm talking bad neighborhood in Baltimore, I'm talking about, like, the shit you see on TV. Like, that the TV shows were made after. So literally, the second you pulled your car into that alley, they could have robbed you and taken your car and left you there, and no one would have known two things about it. You know what I mean? Looking mm-hmm. back on it, it's mm-hmm. like, I cannot believe that I'm still alive or not in jail. Mm-hmm. Right? Because, again, once you turn into that alley, all it takes is a policeman to drive by at the end, and then you're fucked, right? Mm-hmm. And back then, you're going to jail. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they would approach your car, and they would keep it in their sleeves.
Makes sense.
Is how it worked. And there was a lot of them. And it was you could tell it was a well-oiled system that you weren't even going to try to cause any trouble. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was just, but that's how we did it. Yeah, and you bought dime bags. But also what I find really
funny... So would you buy one at a time?
That's what I was going to share. Is that because I don't know what it was, but because I knew I was going to want some later, it wasn't about buying just one dime bag. I would sometimes go and buy like six dime bags so that I didn't have to constantly go to the alley every day.
Yeah.
You know, because it wasn't a fun... It was a scary thing to do, honestly. You know, just the thought of knowing what you had to go through to go get, you know... It's very scary to think about. It's a miracle when I look back on it that nothing bad ever happened to me. Because something very bad very well could have happened, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Definitely a crazy, crazy time in life. Yeah. And definitely very different than, you know, it's kind of funny because you can, you know, as somebody who's also 44, you know, you can say to your son, you know, something like, well, I think we might have even joked about this before, where you have no idea what life was like before the internet. You know, we used to have to use the card catalog, and we used to have to use the phone book if we wanted a phone number, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And now it's almost like you could say the same thing, where, like, you have no idea what it was like before cannabis was legal and you had the dispensary down the street. You used to have to go to an alley and buy it, you know? it's just wow. Funny how time has changed. And then it also just speaks to the social injustice that goes on in the cannabis industry, because when I look at, I think about this because literally every person that I bought weed from was a person of color. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those people of color ended up in jail. And then I bring it up
because... And for the listeners, could you state your own race, please?
Oh, I am a white male, obviously. Right. Or not obviously.
Obviously, yeah.
I said obviously as the male part, but then I realized sometimes people don't realize I'm a male.
You know?
But anyway, yeah, I'm a white male. But I sometimes think about white privilege and the fact that, you know, so many people of color are in jail for cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
Infractions, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And so many white people are, you know, getting fucking flour delivered to their front door.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that people of color aren't also getting flour delivered, but I think you understand the kind of point that I'm trying to make is that...
Well, it's not all and none. It's, you know, it's how the numbers skew.
Right, right. You know? Exactly, exactly. And I think that one thing that's been really eye-opening for me here in Oregon is that the cannabis industry is a very white male-dominated industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there are different people out there that are trying to do things differently. And I think that, you know, for example, I just started working with this new farm, new farm for me, called Oso Verde Farms, and that's a queer person of color farm in Southern Oregon.
What was their name again?
Oso Verde. Yeah, they're located in Southern Oregon. They're queer people of color owned. They're an amazing farm, and I'm just about... I actually have some of their samples here that I can share with you, but I'm about to place an order with them.
Caso Verde?
Oso Verde.
Oso Verde, yeah, I scribbled that first word.
Oso, yeah. And, you know, we can certainly talk more about this, but I think that it's important to to work for some change in what we're doing in the cannabis industry, and
absolutely,
and that's something that I think really starts at the ground level. And like I said, it goes back to, you know, people of color being locked up while white folks are getting the shit delivered, and it's still happening. I mean, let's be honest, it's still happening.
Yeah, I think the proportions are still there. It's just smaller numbers.
Yeah, and I know that right now, you know, I don't want to misspeak, and I could be wrong on what I'm about to say, but I think if it hasn't happened already, California is about to get rid of a lot of past convictions that have been on the books.
Yeah, National Expungement Week
is
a thing.
They
want to do it every year. It's like a week in like whichever city and whichever state is legalizing, where a whole bunch of lawyers come together to get all the forms, you know, signed and envelopes lit type of shit. Like, you know, get the whole scene taken care of and wrapped up. And they want to do it like every year. Who's making the money off of it? You can say it makes sense, and it does in the capitalist sense. Like, yeah, people who have a lot of money to invest are going to come and invest in these companies. These new emerging companies are here because of the undoing of a massive injustice.
Right.
Clearly, the reparations should begin with the communities who bore the brunt of all of that bullshit. Yeah, man, and that's something that even as a consumer you can do. What's one thing you can do to support, you know, communities of color in the cannabis industry, or queer folks in the industry? You can Google search queer-owned dispensary. You can Google search POC-owned dispensary, you know, black dispensary, whatever. That's what I did. Right. I only found one queer-owned dispensary in the city, and it's not even there anymore. But I remember, just going in there and meeting the people, you know, who work there, and being like, if I am going to spend money, you know, I'm going to... Yeah, it was just a really easy way, you know, sort of voting with your dollar.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's important. And I do think that a lot of people here in Portland do that.
Because my old dealer is going to do just fine without me, you know, but these businesses, I think it's important that they do well. And I want to see to it that, you know, I want to do what I can, you know, or not even do what I can, just here's a thing I can do.
Right, absolutely.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's important, like you were saying, to, you know, really decide where you spend your money. And I think that Portland specifically, in my experience, has more of a conscious population than some other cities that I may have lived in.
To a point, it's true.
But in my image of Portland so far, people here are very into you know, understanding where their dollars going, and they seem very into different causes here, you know, whereas some communities I've lived in the past might not be as involved, you know, definitely making an informed decision more so than in other places. Yeah.
Like, whatever you're doing, there's pretty much a way here in Portland, I feel, for that to be done for the betterment of your fellow people.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, cannabis actually plays a... I think that cannabis plays a huge part in kind of like the overall success of Portland. And the reason that I say that is I was doing some research the other day of why people are attracted to Portland. Like, I was trying to figure out why people come here. Mm-hmm. And I was a little bit surprised to find that there are no major companies in Portland that draw people here. But no, I was, you know, people were saying, like, you know, a lot of cities have... Excuse me, like major corporations like Google or Amazon, mm-hmm. or something like that based in the city. And it doesn't seem like Portland has a lot of major corporations based here. You know, so my point is that it seems like a lot of the job market here is dominated by the cannabis industry. And I don't know if that's partly because there's maybe a lack of jobs in other areas. I don't know.
See, I live inside the bubble, so I think, isn't this what every place does?
Right.
You know, like, isn't there like a chic boutique that's cannabis based that just pops up because it's legal now? You know, like, I just assume that's, you know, the steps.
Right. I don't know. I mean, it does seem like the industry employs a crap ton of people. You know.
Yeah.
So I do wonder. Like, I think of it this way: if for whatever crazy reason that I know, or at least I hope will never happen. If suddenly Portland was forced to shut down the entire legal industry, mm-hmm. what would that do to the job market in Portland? And what would that do to the economy in Portland? Yeah, if for some reason every farm had to shut down, every, you know, dispensary, every lab, like everything involved with cannabis, mm-hmm. if for whatever reason had to shut down, how many people would that put out of work, and what would that do to the Portland economy?
I don't know. Portland has had a pretty prolonged surplus of qualified labor.
Right.
Definitely since I moved here in the early aughts, and I'm pretty sure for a while before that, like, there were a lot of only overly qualified because of the existing job market, but just people with degrees and experience moving here that couldn't find work.
Right, right.
You know, people with job histories that moved here and couldn't very easily find work, or had to take a step down, or kind of a step back career-wise or vocation-wise.
Mm-hmm.
When you say, like, if, you know, all the cannabis industry and market and employment all were to cease, I'd be like, wow, yeah, that'd be a whole lot of unemployed talent in the streets again, you know?
Yeah.
A whole bunch of people who are really good at things, you know, but don't have jobs.
Right.
Really important.
It's certainly something that I don't want to entertain, the idea of it ever happening. And I, you know, don't get me wrong, I don't think it will.
You have manager experience, you'll be all right.
Oh, no, I don't even think of it that way. I mean, sure, partly, but I think of it as... I remember there was a time when I used to worry. I'm going to be very serious here for a second. I used to worry about when I got old, how was I going to be able to get my cannabis? You know, like back before it was ever legal, and back, you know, I'm talking like maybe back in my, like not that long ago, but like at least a while ago, I thought, you know, how am I going to be able to obtain cannabis when I'm old and maybe not working anymore? And so I do find comfort knowing that I'm in a state where it's at least legal, where I can at least walk down to the corner and buy it from the shop, whereas in a state where it might not be legal. Because truth be told, when I first moved to Massachusetts, I had an extremely hard time finding a hookup. And I only found a hookup because of a friend of a friend of a friend. And that hookup turned it to be the 15-year dealer, right?
Okay.
But again, it didn't happen quickly. And there was a time when I first moved to Massachusetts, I want to say probably for the first year that I lived in Massachusetts, you're not going to believe what I'm about to tell you. I used to drive back to New York to buy cannabis.
I've heard of people doing that.
Because I just could not find it in Massachusetts, and I had my dealer still in New York. So I would drive down, I'd rent a car once a month, and buy my shit. Like when you think about the money that was spent, it's just astronomical. What I did to make sure that I had my cannabis, you know.
So how much are you smoking in a month then?
Now it's hard to
back then, like, would you pick up like an ounce or something?
Oh yeah. So yeah, back then I always allotted myself for an ounce.
Ounce a month?
An ounce a month, yeah.
That's all right.
And sometimes that wouldn't last, quite honestly. You know, and you'd have to
smoke joints.
And you'd have exactly. And you'd have to get a little more. It's just definitely comforting now knowing that it's at the very least legal. And as an old man, God willing, I can at least still, me and my walker, get down the street to the dispensary. Because I do anticipate that I will be smoking until the day I die. Because as I've, you know, shared with you before, I consume both recreational and medicinally. You know, I definitely use it to treat stress and anxiety. I was on antidepressants for several years. And I'm no longer on them. I used CBD to get off of them. Exactly. Don't get me wrong. I fucking love to get high. Yeah, there's definitely a medicinal part for me. And so I don't anticipate there ever being a time where I don't want to or need to consume cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, going back to what I was saying, I would worry that I was going to be like this old man and having no way to get my medicine. And that caused a lot of stress. Yeah, it's scary to think about, you know, in the long-term grand scheme of your life. But I do take comfort, again, I take comfort in thinking that a huge part of my clientele is elderly people. And it's exactly what I'm talking about, that I want to be available for myself. And a lot of them are treating medicinal problems from cancer to epilepsy to, you know, you name it. You know, I could list condition after condition after condition. And some of them do just want to, you know, be high, and good for them, you know, and they've earned it.
I think that's going to be kind of a new mentality for people to, you know, adopt to, that it's not a real hard dichotomy between medical and responsible adult use or recreational, however you want to say it.
Right.
Maybe it's this radical idea that medicine can be pleasant or enjoyable.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, I kind of chuckle that you use the word radical, because while I agree with you, it is radical, the reason I chuckle is because it's like, at the same time, it's radical, but so fucking basic. You know what
I
mean?
Like, getting better should feel good.
Right.